Mornings are better with a warm beverage, even for Latter-day Saints. Meet Postum, the ideal coffee alternative and proud sponsor of This Week in Mormons podcast. Spot it on the coffee aisle at Smith's Grocery or at your local nearby store. Can't locate it? No worries. Order it at Postum.com. Explore delicious recipes to tailor your Postum experience. Start your day off right with Postum.
Welcome, listener, to This Week in Mormons with Matt and Melissa. How are you doing, Melissa?
Hey, Maddie. I'm so good. How are you?
I'm doing great.
We're back today for another interview.
We are. I'm going to call him a distinguished scholar because he's distinguished and a scholar.
I like that.
Justin Vaughn. He's at Coastal Carolina University. And what listeners might know him for recently is there was a survey done of scholars where they measure presidential greatness, and they have a ranking where they rank presidents in terms of their greatness. And on President's Day, I noticed it was getting a lot of play on the national news. Some people at Fox News were upset about some components, and some people at other outlets were upset about various components. And so we invited Justin on to talk about that survey and how it's done, and also just to talk about Justin also lived in Boise for a long time, and so we want to know what he thinks about living among members of the church, because Justin is not a member of our church.
Now, Justin, Coastal Carolinas, what Carolina is that?
South Carolina.
Okay.
Yeah, it's just a few miles from Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. So I think technically the mailing address of the university is Conway, South Carolina, but it's Myrtle Beach area for people who've been there or know where Myrtle Beach is.
I love Myrtle Beach.
It's a nice place, you know. I tell my friends it's a great place to live in the sense that it's where people go to go on vacation with their families, and so it's got a very family vacation vibe to it, and you can kind of be on vacation all year long.
And the beach there is nice. Like, there's the California beaches where it's kind of not a lot of sand and very cold water. Mm-hmm. Myrtle Beach isn't like that. There's lots of sand and the water's warm, and you can walk out forever. I think it's a fun place to hang out.
Yeah. I think that's exactly right.
Now, this survey that Matt was talking about. Now, listen, Matt is a political science professor. Okay. So y'all are going to have a lot of fun things to talk about that I know nothing about. But here's what I do know. Okay. My kids, who are young adults, so between like 19 and 26 years old, all of them heard about this survey. So what that says to me is that it made the rounds on social media because they're not going to Fox News or to CNN. They're sad to say, getting their news on TikTok and Instagram. So what that means to me is it made a real breakthrough through all the generations, which is pretty cool, actually.
Yeah, that is really cool to hear. You know, I mentioned it in one of my classes, and I hadn't, you know, after it had come out, and one of my students who probably before that was not listening, kind of suddenly turned around and said, "Wait, that was you?" And I was like, "Yeah." So she had also heard about it. And I can tell you, she does not pay much attention to political science. So I kind of felt good. But yeah, it got a ton of play. And, you know, this is the third of these surveys that we've done over the last decade or so. And we release them on President's Day when we do them, and on purpose, because people are paying attention to presidents. But it is each time gets global attention, and you know, the New York Times wrote an article about it. I think the thing that tickled me the most this time, though, was that Mark Hamill, who played Luke Skywalker in Star Wars, tweeted about it. And so I feel like I don't care who sends me hate mail. Luke Skywalker liked it.
You've got the Luke force Skywalker's is with on your team. Yeah, the force is with you.
Well, so Justin, who are these scholars that took this survey?
Well, Matt, I believe you're one of them. I hope.
Yes, I am.
So there are Matt and 153 of the other best presidency scholars in the country. It's a group. I think it's technically interdisciplinary, but overwhelmingly political scientists. And what we have done is we branched out a little bit over the years. The first couple times we did it, we surveyed members of a group who are members of the American Political Science Association, but specifically are scholars who are members of a group that study the American presidency, which I think, Matt, is probably how you and I first met many years ago. And then this time around, we did that again. But then we added, because we wanted to get a little more of an interdisciplinary feel. And so we also then went and found scholars who had recently published, you know, peer-reviewed research over the last 5 years in top academic journals or on university presses that weren't necessarily members of this specific group. And so we ended up sending out about 500 or so invitations. We had about 200 people click the link, start to fill out the survey. And we had just over 150 who completed it at least far enough into the survey that they weighed in on the greatness of the individual presidents. And then we had a bunch of other questions in there too about things like who's the most polarizing president or the most underrated president or who should be on Mount Rushmore next. But
we're going to ask about each of those in just a second.
Yeah.
But first I want to know, so I imagine you asked them about their political leanings. So I know Melissa tells me all the time that academia is full of a bunch of liberal people that hate conservatives. Is that kind of what you're Oh, sorry. Go ahead. Sorry. Who is academia, Melissa?
I don't think there's hate.
Oh, okay.
I don't think there's like
disdain.
Vision. No, but I think most college professors are more liberal leaning. That's all I think.
Is that kind of how your sample looked?
Yeah, you know, Matt, you might regret inviting me out of this after I say this, but you should listen to your sister because at least in this instance, she's right. Our sample, and we, you know, I told you how we created it. I think that, we're 90%, left of center on it. And so, there's a very small minority that identify as conservative or identify as Republican, not shocking based on what we know about higher education. But yeah, it's not representative of the public, but it is representative, I think, of
academia.
The discipline in academia.
Yeah. And it doesn't mean that they can't be impartial in their answers to questions.
True. That's right. And I guess I think we have evidence probably maybe pointing to both sides of that. But for example, one of the things we found is that, you know, and we can talk more about this in a moment, but President Trump does very poorly in this survey, but he does poorly among Democrats and Republicans. It's not like the Democrats rated him poorly and the Republican study is pretty good. Mm-hmm. Everybody rated him at the bottom. And so that shows you the difference between conservative political scientists or Republican political scientists and everyday Republican voters. Mm-hmm. But then at the same time, I think this time around, we've seen some ideological movement in some of the responses that would indicate that while these professors who participated in the study can fill out the survey with their professor hat on and not their partisan hat, that they might have been wearing a little bit of the partisan hat too, that Democrats all went up from the last time we did it. Modern Republicans all went down from the last time we did it. And it's not like we've learned anything new about Ronald Reagan that would cause us to reassess him from 5 years ago. But I think my explanation for it is that like with much of America, all of America, it's a very tense political moment and emotions are heightened in the electorate, in politicians. And I think it's true for the academy as well. And so I think we see evidence of that in our results this time compared to previous times.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that Trump came out ranked so lowly because he's recently out of office? Is that something you see often when presidents are first out of office that they're ranked more low, or is it just Trump?
I think it's just Trump because he was in office when we did it the last time and he came in, last then as well. And so he didn't go up, but he didn't, I guess he couldn't go down. But so there was no kind of post presidential change. I think that, and maybe Trump will defy this. I think that there's a chance, and we've seen a little bit with George W. Bush where, as time goes by, wounds heal, memories shorten, worse examples come into office. Right. And so there's a little bit of forgiveness. We've seen it a little bit with Richard Nixon. We've seen it a lot with Lyndon Johnson. I don't know if we'll see that with President Trump, probably not for a long time, but eventually you'll probably get people to assess him on different criteria than maybe what they're assessing him on at this particular moment.
So what did you learn about how well presidency scholars know all of the presidents? Because there were some you asked me to rank that I was like, I don't know exactly where I would put Fillmore in this list.
Yeah, I think I agree with you about that. And one of the things that we do, that, and Matt, you'll know this, before we ask people to rate each individual president, we also ask them how much they feel they know about each individual president. And as you might expect, we don't know as much about the 19th century presidents. And partly that's because political scientists study the modern institution. Mm-hmm. Partly that's because it was a long time ago. And partly that's because the presidency wasn't as important in the 19th century as it is in the 20th century. So those people like Millard Fillmore, unfortunately for people like Millard Fillmore, or even more so Franklin Pierce or James Buchanan, if we remember them at all, it's for bad reasons, unless you're Abraham Lincoln.
Remember them at all. I don't.
So, it's one of the things I guess I'll notice is that political scientists don't know a lot about the presidents, or don't know as much about the presidents prior to Teddy Roosevelt and after those kind of founding era presidents. And that either means they kind of get jumbled in the middle because we don't really have an opinion about them, or they're at the bottom because the only thing we remember is they were bad on slavery, or they misplayed the years leading up to the Civil War or something.
So who do they want to add to Mount Rushmore, and who do they want to take away?
We never have asked take away. That's a good one for next time. I like that idea. I'm going to guess people. Ooh.
Wait, who's on Mount Rushmore? I'm sorry. I'm playing the dumb one, but I am the dumb one. Who's on Mount Rushmore? Well, I know there's four.
Don't feel dumb, because it says George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, and Teddy Roosevelt.
Okay.
But the first time we asked this question, we realized that a non-trivial percentage of our professors identified presidents who are already on there. And so the second and third time we did that, we took those options off. But you can't vote for George Washington anymore. So those are the four. Overwhelmingly, the answer has been, each time we've done the survey, that Franklin Roosevelt should be the next president added on. And that makes sense for a lot of reasons. Is the greatest president of the 20th century. Is he longest serving president? Only president elected four times, led through the Great Depression and World War II. Very momentous president. And he regularly comes in, either two or three in these kinds of surveys. In our survey, he came in two, just by a hair over George Washington, after Abraham Lincoln. But FDR is always, it has for us always been the answer to that question. But I think that's a fascinating idea of who would you take off. And I got to figure it's either Teddy Roosevelt or Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah.
But I feel like Thomas Jefferson's about to get canceled. So
I know they want to take his statue out of place. So just knock his face off of Mount Rushmore.
Yep.
So
I can see it happening.
If President Obama makes the rankings of people they would want to add, just because I just wonder if it'd be nice to see some diversity up there.
I think that's an interesting argument. And he came in second this time, but I mean, a very, very distant second. It was, 68% said FDR and 8% said Obama. And then there were a few people who got below 5%. Last time it was about 65% Franklin Roosevelt. Last time was in 2018. We released it. So about the same percentage for Franklin Roosevelt. But then after that, it was a tie between Dwight Eisenhower and Ronald Reagan. And pretty much most of the Republicans said Franklin Roosevelt, but then there was a contingent of Republicans who didn't say FDR that either split for Eisenhower or Reagan.
Okay. Said Reagan because they're imagining the young Reagan when he was really like handsome movie star Reagan. Mm-hmm. I think that's the Reagan that they want up there.
Like bedtime for Bonzo.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm going to give you some Mount Rushmore trivia that's LDS themed, that I don't know if you know this, Justin. Yeah. The guy that carved Mount Rushmore was
Borslem, is that his name?
Yeah. Did you know that he was a member of our church?
I didn't.
So what happened is, he had a dad that had two wives, And then at some point they say polygamy is no more. And his mom was the wife that his dad kicked to the curb. Yeah. And so he grew up hating our church. He went off to Europe to study art and all of that stuff. But he was one of us before we kind of kicked him to the curb and he hated us.
Wow. So that is fascinating. As an outsider, I knew that there's been shifts on the attitudes towards polygamy. But so when that shift happened, then I never thought about what people did with their existing families.
I didn't either. Did they just pick which wife they wanted to keep? Was that common? Yeah.
Well, so Idaho as a state was very anti-polygamy. And so when the church changed, there was a whole lot of legal pressure for these people to follow the law. In Utah, it really was regional, Justin, like depending on where you were. But there is a story in Heber J. Grant's Heber J. Grant. Anyhow, somebody comes to Salt Lake City because they want to get married to their plural wife. And then there's this manifesto in General Conference that week where they say, no more polygamy. And so they approach the prophet and they say, what are we supposed to do? And he's like, I guess you got to go to Mexico to get married because you can't do it. So there was a period of time where polygamy continued even after it officially ended. And so because there were these questions of like, what do you do with, I have all of these children and all of these spouses, and what am I supposed to do to take care of them? And people made just various choices about how to handle that.
So famously, Mitt Romney came from the Mexican Mormons, mm-hmm. the Mormons who were in Mexico for polygamy.
Yeah.
He came from that family families.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. You would think there would be a grandfather clause, right? Like, okay, no more plural marriages, but if you're in one.
Yeah. Well, and so then there was the grandfather clause. Because there had been that Supreme Court case, there was a lot of politics involved in it too. So I'm always going to be biased in these presidential greatness surveys because I'm always going to put Benjamin Harrison and Grover Cleveland really high because they pardoned, they granted amnesty and pardoned Mormon polygamists. And for me, that's like, hurrah, you're a great president.
You're the one for Benjamin Harrison. Now I know.
he's the one who's skewing your study over and over again.
That's awesome. I that's so interesting.
Yeah.
It's funny how when you start, you know, you're like, okay, I knew that happened, but then you take the conversation a level beyond, like, oh, but what would the implication of that have been? And then, you know, I wonder if, you know, in the granite there's you know, some mysterious message nobody has discovered.
Decipher
his anger at his father.
I like that idea. I like that. In fact, I'm pushing for that conspiracy theory. I'm going to start spreading it. Mm-hmm. I like it. Mm-hmm.
It's in the inside of Lincoln's nose.
Yes.
So Justin, I'm going to transition to kind of Mormon culture kinds of things. Sure. I don't know if you'll remember this, but one time I was having a conversation with you and I think you said you had been raised in the evangelical movement and you said to me, you Mormons are so cool. Like as an evangelical, I was always like taught to like evangelize and kind of teach and try and push people. And you Mormons have never done that. You've never like tried to teach me the gospel, And then as a member of our church, I was like, uh-oh, wait a minute. I think I kind of like fail. I think I sent Justin the wrong message. Cause we're supposed like at church, we're always told evangelize. And you're like, you guys are awesome. You never do that. And so I wonder, is that kind of your perception generally of members of the church? Are they evangelical in the way that evangelicals are taught to be? Or are they more like me where we don't really talk about it much?
Well, so I obviously am coming from a position of ignorance and so I'm going to share what I feel like I have inferred through, you know, living in a place where there are lots of Mormons and knowing people and having friends that are Mormons, and how it was different. And also, I guess different. And even now I moved from Idaho to South Carolina several months ago and I have been invited to church more times in the last 6 months than I have in the last 15 years. And hey, you seem like a nice person. Welcome to our community. You want to come to our church. And that's, you know, after living among many Mormons and also people of other denominations for a dozen years in Boise, I don't think it happened once other than when people who are on missions knocked on my door, you know. But my hunch is, my hypothesis, and I don't know if I'm right, is that that while the evangelical Christian faith is obviously very outward focused, and so is the Mormon church, that you all like institutionalize it through missions. And so there are periods, there are people around the world at any given moment whose job it is to be doing that. Right. And so I felt like that takes the pressure off of the everyday citizens to be having to do that kind of thing. Whereas I remember I grew up in I don't think we called it evangelical then, but it would be considered that today. But I grew up in what was the denomination was the North American Baptist, whatever, and association. And you know, my dad became a pastor later, but he was the music pastor, the music minister at our church. And, you know, we'd be at church 2-3 nights a week, whether it was for choir practice or for youth group or whatever. And there was a organization called Awana. I think it still exists. In fact, I know it does because I drive past this church on my way to work and they have a sign for it. But it was basically like a evangelical Boy Scouts. And you would meet and you'd learn the Boy Scout kinds of things, but then you'd also do lots of Bible verse memory and lots of, you know, learning lessons from the Bible, but and also lots of just like basic sales techniques in terms of, it's like we're always learning new ways to recruit our friends from school to church.
And, really?
You know, whether it was we're going to have a big pizza party at church next Wednesday, everybody has to bring one friend. You know, I don't know why I remember this, but I still remember tomorrow at school. Dates me, but you know, we used to have pencil sharpeners, right? Which when was the last time you used a pencil sharpener? but I remember they said, tomorrow at school, you'll see somebody that you're friends with get up and sharpen their pencil. Just go up and stand behind them, and while you're standing there sharpen your pencil, invite them to church on Sunday. and so it was that every week, just constant kind of, we got to get them here. Get them to come to Bible camp, get them to come to Christian, you know, the summer vacation Bible school. And, there's a real focus on recruitment, and I don't mean that in a negative or cynical way, but those are the people that I grew up with who were very kind of strong in their faith. And then, you know, I got to know Mormons as I went to college and graduate school, had a friend from graduate school who came to Boise before I did. And it had kind of a similar experience. I knew he was very strong in his faith and yet never once broached the subject with me in terms of, hey, you should come to church with me sometime. And it wasn't because he didn't care or because about me, or it wasn't because he didn't care about his faith. It was just that evangelical element wasn't there.
What do you think about that, Melissa?
Well, that was fascinating. I have a lot of thoughts about that. I think that what you're describing is kind of a little bit like Mormons are taught in a little bit of a way. Like every time we have a talk about it or a general conference, you know, talk about it, it's always like be normal and natural and make friends with people. And maybe they want to come to church because they see a little bit of you acting like Jesus and they want to learn more about this Jesus person, right? But it's not that there's not the pressure to bring people with you. There definitely is. But it's just we're not given direct instructions, I guess, on how to do that. But I also think it's really interesting to hear that you grew up like that with your dad as a pastor. One thing that Mormons do a lot is the home church kind of a thing. So we're scripture study every morning, we're prayers night and day, we're prayers before food, we have, you know, family home evening lessons on Mondays. Was church a thing that you did at church, or what was the growing up implementing of the gospel inside the home like? Pretty similar?
That's a good question. Well, church is We were at church a lot. And I think church was like the cornerstone of our social life. And also my parents both had large families. And, so it was either church or family. And my dad's
same thing, kind of, huh?
Same church as us. But then again, I also know that, my parents, if we watched TV, it was either the Disney Channel or it was a religious station. If we watched a movie, it was either a Disney movie or a religious movie. We listened to music. It was either the soundtrack to a Disney movie or it was Christian music.
That sounds like my house.
Yeah. Even like the novels that we would get for Christmas, they'd be Christian novels, you know? And so until we were probably in junior high, and I was the oldest. So probably until I was in junior high, there was kind of, a cultural bubble that I grew up in that, you know, there was a Christian bookstore. That was where we went and got books, where we got tapes, where we got CDs. And that was the culture that we consumed. And then I think by the time you kind of get into junior high and high school, it probably becomes very difficult for a parent to shield their child from the secular, world. But yeah, so culturally, church was kind of everywhere we went, right? I can still kind of, I think in my nightmares, I hear like the songs of the kids' music tapes that my mom probably hadn't listened to in her van driving us around for 20 right. years. But, but yeah, so yeah, it was pretty ever present.
So when you get to Boise, does it feel like there's this other Mormon cultural bubble people are living in and you're excluded from that in some way?
You know, I never felt excluded. I never felt excluded. You know, I did, when I moved to Boise, I worked at the university for several years and then I left academics for a while and was working in politics. And then I recently have gone back to, academics, but, I think I became aware that there was a Mormon network of kind of what I would call civic/business leaders. That they had something in common that I was not going to have in common with them. That doesn't mean I wasn't friends with them, that they wouldn't do business with me or that they wouldn't, you know, be allies on different things, but there was just a thing we didn't share, that, was, you know, obvious to me, but not in a negative way, just I'm not in that tribe. You know,
like they would have been welcoming in the tribe, but you would have had to go to church with them or something like that to get in.
Probably. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I frequently wonder about that because obviously I recognize that I'm in the tribe. Right. And I always wonder, like, are we excluding people from this tribe? But as you describe your childhood, it seems like people kind of do that in all kinds of social circles in their lives. And it's not a unique to us kind of thing.
Right. I think that's right. And I think that oftentimes, and I don't think this is the case for your church, but I think oftentimes, you know, for a lot of people in a lot of situations, if they're part of a group, sometimes there's just as much, a group identity only matters if there are people who don't get to share it, right? Mm-hmm. Like a club only matters if there's people who can't be in the club. And I don't think that's the case for your faith or even for most faiths, but, it's not, I never viewed it as like an elite thing that I just couldn't qualify for, but just more of a,
Yeah.
Well, I think that is actually, that's interesting. I think that is one of the bigger struggles with our church right now is that there are actually some people who feel like they're not invited in. I think that's one of the things me and Matt think about a lot is that there are people primarily in the LGBTQ community who feel uninvited from our faith. And even though as a big picture, our faith says things like, you know, you're welcome, you're invited, you know, we love you, we want you. It doesn't feel that way to some of those people. And I think, you know, largely that's one of the biggest struggles our church is having right now.
That's a good question. Cause I guess asking me, it's a very social question. But I think, I'm all the default markers, right? It's, you know, straight white male, right? Like I have not had a problem in my life in like being allowed into spaces. And so, that's interesting. That's interesting. I did find, and so I have a number of friends and even business relationships that I would have some of the most interesting conversations with. There was a good friend of mine, that we would get together often for, and he worked, for Zions Bank, and or probably still works for Zions Bank. But, you know, I was exploring doing some business development in Salt Lake City when I was working in the private sector. And he and I would meet up, I don't know, every other month, probably before the pandemic. And we'd always go, and I guess it makes sense, you know, now that I'm thinking about it, but we always go have a meet up and have a donut. And, and I said to him, hey, I think I'm going to go down to Salt Lake a few times over the next few months and try to really purposefully do some business development. But my go-to in terms of getting to know somebody is to invite them out for a cup of coffee or for happy hour. And I don't think either of those are good moves. and so what is the acceptable alternative? Right. And, cause I don't think, cause you know, you're not going to invite somebody out for dinner cause yeah. that's a, I don't know, more intimate thing, but, I don't know if this is just a thing for him or this will resonate with you all, but he clued me in on something that he called light breakfast.
Oh,
and he said, oh, what you want to do is invite them out for a light breakfast. And I was like, that phrase exactly. And he's like, yeah, that they'll know exactly what that means. It means a cup of coffee. They're not going to drink a cup of coffee. You can drink a cup of coffee. They might have orange juice, piece of toast, but that's the networking version of, you want to get a cup of coffee or you want to get happy hour. And I said, oh, how fascinating. Cause you had to have those, well, I guess you wouldn't call it social lubricants, right? But you have to have those, those things that where yeah. you can have, be in a semi-formal or semi-casual environment and build relationships. But I didn't know, but my go-tos would not have been appropriate in that arena most of the time.
Yeah. Academia has kind of trained me to ask people to have a cup of coffee. Right. So even yeah. among LDS scholars, we'll be like, hey, you want to go for some coffee, even though none of us are going to drink coffee. That's just the lingo that we've learned, but it's true in Utah. If I said, hey, you want to go get a cup of coffee? They'd be like, what are you talking about? I don't right. want to get a cup of coffee.
Well, and you know, I think my friend at the time, I said, no one's going to hold it against you if you ask them if they want to have a cup of coffee. But if you're talking about not wanting to have a sign on your head that says I'm not in your tribe, and that's maybe not the thing to lead with. Okay.
So let me ask you about some kind of fun Mormon stereotypes. Well, let me ask you first, if there's a celebrity or a person in the media, when somebody says Mormon, that you kind of go to, like, that's your picture of who a Mormon is.
Well, I think it's Mitt Romney.
Makes sense. Sure.
Yeah. Mitt Romney's the first person I think of. And part of that's but I think that was true before the presidential election. Mm-hmm. You know, when he was governor of Massachusetts and a business leader, I think he's the person that I would even then have thought of, but then especially since, you know, the 2012 campaign, you know, he's the person I think of.
I think he consistently looks like a politician. Like, he looks like a candidate, but also he looks like a Mormon. he has that look about him to me.
Well, so then that's another stereotype question I have. Which of these would you say is more true, that Mormons are stylish or that Mormons overdress?
You know, I guess I'm trying to think of the people I know. You know, you all, I guess even the guys have a little bit of a flair, like, so maybe I would say stylish.
Nice. You're making me feel good inside.
Is that a value that's kind of shared in the community?
It's right? a contested value, Justin. I would say it's something that there are Mormons that are definitely stylish, but then there's these other Mormons that are very judgmental of stylish. Don't you think that's true, Melissa?
Well, I think that there's this pushback against what Mormons used to look like, which was very homely, stay-at-home wife, right? Like very, I don't know. Homely is the right word. And I think modern Mormons, they're like these mommy bloggers, right? So they want to be very hip and very stylish. And so there's kind of this wide swing away from what I think, you know, I mean, think about the I don't know. I'm thinking about like the pioneer dress kind of a look that or like, I'm going to wear jeans and a t-shirt and they're, you know, like, I think there's a big swing away from that. And so I think like modern Mormons actually are very trendy and very stylish and almost, I think, materialistic in the way that they present themselves to some extent.
When Matt first asked that question, I was thinking about like Mormon men. But as soon as you said that, yeah, there is definitely this like, and I imagine in the minds of younger Americans that are more social media present, this female Utah aesthetic that I think is growing. What does a Mormon look like? What does a Mormon woman look like? Big blonde hair, right. fancy clothes, looks wealthy.
Yes. We actually had this I teach high school. So in one of my classes, this was connected. I can't go into all the way how, but I said, let's just make a list here on the whiteboard of the Utah mom stereotype. And yes, it was hair extensions, fake eyelashes. They drive a white Suburban or a white SUV, very much like a white t-shirt and jeans, but all of the bling everywhere else. And carry a Stanley cup. They wear leggings, but they're name brand Lululemon leggings, not, you know, like, so yeah, I think there's a big stereotype.
That's interesting. I don't know. I guess that's not a good stereotype, but I don't know if it's the worst stereotype.
Well, so here's another one. Outside of Utah, when I had friends and I'd have them over for dinner or something, they would always bring a bottle of wine. I think that's a common thing for people to do. Or if you move into a neighborhood, they'll present some kind of a gift, and usually it would be alcohol or maybe, I don't know. But what I've noticed Mormons do is we bring food. We bring cookies and brownies and like plates of like unhealthy things to eat. And I wonder, did you ever experience anything like that where people are bringing food to your house? And like, how did that feel to you?
I never experienced that. Well, you mean when I was growing up in my church or?
No. From Mormons.
Oh no. You know, I never experienced it from Mormon. Though when I moved to Boise, I had a friend from graduate school who was there and was established, very active in church, and went out of his way to help me kind of find everything I needed. Washer and dryer. Hey, I got a friend who has an extra one. I'll take care of it for you. Right. Very service oriented, very, you know, I got kind of into the, if I had kids, I'm sure I would have been offered hand-me-downs, you know? but one thing I noticed one time, so we went to the same graduate school and our school at Texas A&M, and Texas A&M was playing in a bowl game, one winter. And so it would have been a few days before Christmas. And so I went over to his house. I'd often go to his house and watch the bowl games or watch the A&M games in general. And the doorbell just like every 5 minutes kept ringing. And it was just neighbors and friends dropping off small gifts. And then he'd be like, oh, hey, we got one for you too. And I said, how do you have so many gifts just waiting for people? And he's like, oh, come here and look in the, you know, like an extra bedroom. It was just filled with like nice and inexpensive things. And it's just like, yeah, we're going to go drive around later and stop by and say hello to some of our friends and give them a little gift. But if, you know, there's people we didn't think of, we got extras. And it was just an insight into an interesting tradition. I bet you, over the course of that 4 hours I was at his house, 20 times people stopped by and just kind of, people were making their rounds and lots of plates of cookies and tins of whatever. And so,
that sounds very familiar.
Yeah. But it was nice, you know, and it was also, a sign of how much of a community he was in.
Yeah.
Well, I am glad to hear that also that, like, as far as service, like, I do feel like that's something that is noticeable in my community, at least to me. And my husband is one who he is consistently out helping people, asking how we can help, you know, oh, I've got a truck, I've got a shovel, I've got, what do you need? Yeah. Like even just yesterday, he drove up the canyon because someone texted him and said, my truck got stuck and can you tow me out? And he said, yeah, I'll be up in a few minutes, you know, and I think that's kind of his nature and who he is. But I do think that there is something pretty consistent about the fact that you look around and if you need something, you know that you can ask and that people will help you out. I do kind of like that.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel that way, Justin, that if you needed help, you could ask your friends and they would, your Mormon friends, and they would be there for you or no?
I think, Well, I think like, I mean, Mormons are like everybody, that I think there are people who I would have had more faith than others, but that, but probably I would say more so than people who I would identify with other groups.
Yeah.
I'll say I had, I was always impressed by the like, child rearing, and it seems like there were always really good kids. And, you know, this friend of mine, his son ended up, he would come over and mow my yard. And I mean, wow. I'd have to force him to take money. And you know, actually one time, this maybe will be funnier to you than me. I didn't realize until like 2 months later why this was funny. The nicest kid in the world. I can't imagine. I mean, he was a teenager, so I'm sure he gave his mom and dad a hard time here or there, but I couldn't imagine it happening. Super respectful, super kind, always smiling. And he came over and mowed my yard one time, and I gave him a ride back home. And, I think at the time he was maybe 14 or 15. And I asked him if we were just talking about if he was ever going to get a part-time job. And so we were on the way from my house to his parents' house. We drove past an Idaho, or not an Idaho Youth Ranch, What's the Mormon Deseret Industries?
Oh yeah, Deseret Industries.
So we drove by Deseret Industries, and I at this point knew enough that if the word Deseret's involved, it's probably attached to the church, right? And so we drive past a Deseret Industries, and I'm like, hey, I bet you could get a job there. And he just looks at me, he's like, geez, Mr. Vaughn. And then he just kind of got quiet for the rest of the drive home. And I didn't know. And then later I saw his dad and I was talking to him. I'm like, hey. And I told him the story, and his dad starts laughing. And he's like, oh, you don't know what you said to him. So let me tell you about the role that plays in our society. And I was like, oh man, I'm sorry. He's like, oh, he got over it.
Oh, that's great.
But I thought it was funny, but I was also like, how cool that exists and that provides a function in society and kind of economic resilience. And I'm a fan, you know, of the community. I feel like you know, if you're in a place with more Mormons than fewer Mormons, there's going to be good kids and more ice cream options and you know, probably safer drivers
and maybe not a Starbucks.
And maybe not a Starbucks. Well, anymore, most of the things at a Starbucks don't have that much coffee in them. So, yeah.
Hey, well, but, Justin, thank you so much for joining us. It was really great to get to know you better. Thanks for talking to us about your Presidential Greatness Survey. If people want to find out more about that or about you, what should they do?
Oh, you know, I don't do any social media. That's a long conversation. We'd probably better off not getting into. So I guess just, you know, they should reach out to you, Matt, and say, hey, what's Justin been up to? And you can give them a scoop.
That's great. All right. Well, listener, we'll talk to you again next week. Have a good week.